Hello, and welcome to this month's episode of the AJNR Fellows Journal Club podcast, which comes to you from the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. My name is Joel Stein, and I'm assistant professor in neuroradiology. We have three recent articles to share with you, each of which will be discussed by one fellow and one attending. To begin the discussion, here is one of our first-year fellows, Dr. Eric Schmidt.
Hi, my name is Dr. Eric Schmidt, one of the neuroradiology fellows at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and I'll be discussing the article entitled Web Intrasaccular Flow Disruptor, Prospective Multicenter Experience in 83 Patients with 85 Aneurysms by Papaganaki et al. In the November 2014 edition of AJNR. Cerebral aneurysms represent important causes of morbidity and mortality and are often amenable to endovascular treatment. However, many aneurysms are difficult or impossible to treat with standard detachable coils. In particular, aneurysms with unusual anatomy, such as with wide necks or with atypical morphology, may be resistant to standard techniques. The purpose of the article was to evaluate the safety and efficacy of a new device, the woven endoluminal bridge dual layer, or WebDL, in the treatment of cerebral aneurysms. The WebDL is composed of a self-expandable nitinol mesh. When expanded, the device looks like a hollow metallic cage shaped a little bit like a cylinder within a cylinder. The design is intended to modify blood flow at the neck of an aneurysm and promote intra-aneurysmal thrombosis. Like many endovascular devices, the WebDL can be passed through catheters greater than 0.027 inches and is deployed via electrothermal stimulation. In this study, the authors prospectively gathered information on consecutive patients treated with WebDL at 11 neurointerventional centers in France over nearly 30 months. The decision to treat with WebDL was not random, but rather was made by a multidisciplinary team including interventional neuroradiologists, neurosurgeons, and neuroanesthesiologists. All patients received systemic heparinization during the intervention. Gathered data included demographic information, aneurysm characteristics, for example, aneurysm size, shape, and whether the aneurysm was ruptured, complications, morbidity, as assessed with the modified Rankin score, and one-month mortality. The efficacy of WebDL was assessed using angiographic follow-up, although the exact modality depended on the standard protocol of each imaging center. In other words, digital subtraction angiography, MRA, or CTA all were used based on the preferences of individual providers. Imaging was obtained on average 5.3 months following the procedure, with a range of 3 to 24 months. The data analysis itself was fairly simple. Basic summary statistics were calculated to determine the rates of technical success, the complication rate, and aneurysm occlusion rate on follow-up imaging, as well as morbidity and mortality statistics at 1 month. Over the study interval, a total of 83 patients with 85 aneurysms were included. Technical success was observed in 93% of aneurysms. The study documented successful deployment in middle cerebral, basilar, anterior communicating, and internal carotid aneurysms ranging in size from 4.6 to 13.8 millimeters. Technical failures were attributed to difficulty in maneuvering the device in the treatment of three anterior communicating artery aneurysms and to difficulties in visualizing the device in four other cases. Of note, 86% of cases involved wide neck aneurysms, defined as a neck greater than 4 millimeters in diameter. Of the patients with technical success, 13% had complications, usually thromboembolic events. There was one case of inadvertent device detachment and one case complicated by severe subarachnoid hemorrhage. Of the 63% patients with post-procedural follow-up imaging, 57% had complete occlusion and 35% only had a small remnant of the aneurysm neck following treatment. The authors note that this finding probably represents the proximal recess of the device, and therefore subjects in this group also probably had complete occlusion. Of the patients who received clinical follow-up at 1 month, 95% had modified Rankin scores of 0, suggesting no significant morbidity in these patients. There was 0% mortality at 1 month following the procedure. Although these results are intriguing, the study has several limitations that should be considered prior to drawing conclusions. First, even though the data are prospectively gathered, it should be emphasized that they are not part of a defined prospective clinical trial, and therefore the results should be weighted accordingly. Second, the sample is relatively small, and the study only provides descriptive information. Thirdly, it is unclear how patients were selected for treatment with WebDL, as opposed to other potential therapeutic options. The decision was clearly not random, and probably for good reason, but this fact also produces bias in the data that is difficult to quantify. Fourth, the authors do not provide any estimate of the error of their statistics. confidence intervals, or other measures of statistical precision would have been useful. Relatedly, the study does not include a control group. The lack of a head-to-head comparison between this new device and other more traditional interventional options makes it more difficult to understand its relative value, a key piece of information in clinical practice. In their discussion, the authors do compare their experiences with WebDL to other interventions reported in the literature, and they conclude that this new device has similar failure and complication rates to more traditional interventions. However, both the demographic and aneurysm characteristics differ substantially from study to study, limiting direct comparison between samples. Fifth, the WebDL device is not currently available in the United States, decreasing the utility of these results to many readers. Finally, it is important to note that several of the authors have financial relationships with Sequent Medical, the company that manufactures WebDL. Although I found no evidence of bias in my reading of the paper, the potential for conflict of interest should at least be considered. In summary, this study provides evidence that WebDL is a safe and efficacious device for the treatment of cerebral aneurysms, particularly those with wide necks. However, limitations in study design make direct comparisons to other more established percutaneous interventions difficult. This article has been assigned an evidence-based medicine level of 2 by AJNR. Anyone who has been part of a difficult aneurysm coiling will probably understand why I chose this article. Flow disruption devices such as WebDL represent a potential solution to some of the most challenging cases in neurointerventional radiology. As such, the utility of these devices should be carefully researched in order to determine whether or not they warrant inclusion into our growing neurointerventional armamentarium. And now one of my professors, Dr. John Wu, will provide his insights on this study.
Hello, this is John Wu, Associate Professor of Radiology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you, Eric, for that introductory discussion of this interesting article. As you described, this article continues a series of reports on the use of the woven endoluminal bridge dual layer, or WebDL device, for endovascular treatment of intracranial aneurysms. The WebDL is a self-expanding, nitinol mesh, ball-like structure that is manufactured in various sizes, anywhere from about 5 to 10 millimeters. The inventor and developer of the technology, Sequent Medical, has an informative website which I encourage any interested listeners to visit. The WebDL is deployed using standard endovascular techniques through a microcatheter whose tip has been advanced into the lumen of the aneurysm. Once there, it slows flow across the neck enough to achieve a rapid thrombosis. Other articles have described several advantages of the WebDL over existing endovascular treatments. Because of the rapid thrombosis, it can be used in ruptured as well as unruptured aneurysms. It can be used in wide neck aneurysms without requiring balloons or stents, as well as in aneurysms located at bifurcations, theoretically without jeopardizing nearby perforators. Finally, in principle, dual antiplatelet therapy may not be needed once the WebDL is deployed, unlike flow-diverting stents, as the device is purely intrasaccular. Over the years since my fellowship 10 years ago, I've seen a number of various endovascular devices and techniques get introduced into clinical use. It's always interesting to see the latest technology that someone dreamed up, trying to build a better mousetrap, so to speak. The current article builds upon others, showing the safety and efficacy results of this device thus far in the first 83 patients at these 11 neurointerventional centers in France. On the face of it, the complication rates appear comparable to that of other devices, as described in the manuscript. As Eric mentioned, the WebDL is not approved for clinical use in the United States, at least not yet. There is a multi-center clinical trial for single untreated wide neck aneurysms, which just started a few months ago under an IDE, so everyone can look to the future. That concludes our discussion of this article. On to discuss the next is Dr. Dasha Pachursky.
My name is Dasha Pachursky, and I'm a first-year neuroradiology fellow at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. I will discuss the article titled Calvarial Fracture Patterns on CT Imaging Predict Risk of a Delayed Epidural Hematoma Following Decompressive Craniectomy for Traumatic Brain Injury, published in AJNR Online, June 2014, and in print October 2014. This article was of particular interest to us since trauma imaging is ubiquitous and is really applicable to everyday practice whether you're a resident, fellow, or attending. Decompressive craniectomy is used to relieve increased intracranial pressure, often in the setting of trauma. A complication of decompressive craniectomy is the development of a delayed epidural hematoma contralateral to the craniectomy site. It may be present intraoperatively or on postoperative imaging. Potentially fatal complication delayed epidural hematoma often requires a second surgical decompression. Delayed epidural hematoma is associated with the presence of a calvarial skull fracture contralateral to the craniectomy site. While this has previously been reported in the literature, what has not been described is whether varying fracture patterns are associated with different rates of delayed epidural hematoma in patients undergoing decompressive craniectomy. This information would be important to know since preoperative CT imaging implying a high risk of delayed epidural hematoma would warrant earlier postoperative CT imaging and closer monitoring. The goal of the study was to determine if skull fracture patterns on the preoperative CT scan can predict the risk of a delayed epidural hematoma after craniectomy. 203 patients with acute traumatic brain injury who underwent decompressive craniectomy were retrospectively identified. Patients undergoing decompressive craniectomy for non-traumatic causes or for penetrating trauma such as gunshot wounds were excluded. CT imaging studies were analyzed by three neuroradiologists. First, the preoperative CT scans were reviewed without knowledge of whether the patient subsequently developed a delayed epidural hematoma. We noted whether the patient had an epidural hematoma to begin with and if a calvarial fracture was present. Then the postoperative CT images were reviewed for evidence of a delayed epidural hematoma underlying the calvarial fracture. Of the 203 patients who underwent decompressive craniectomy for acute non-penetrating traumatic brain injury, 55 patients had calvarial fractures contralateral to the planned craniectomy site. 33 of 55 patients had single fractures contralateral to the craniectomy site, and 22 of the 55 patients had two or more contralateral calvarial fractures. All 12 patients with delayed epidural hematoma had a skull fracture contralateral to the site of craniectomy with a sensitivity of 100%. Only 3 patients had a single calvarial fracture, while 9 patients had two or more calvarial fractures. When the contralateral calvarial fracture involved two or more bones, there was a statistically significant association with the development of an epidural hematoma with a diagnostic odds ratio of 41. Delayed epidural hematomas were noted to be large in size with a significant amount of associated midline shift. 8 of the patients with delayed epidural hematoma required reoperation, with only 2 patients achieving a favorable outcome, defined in the paper as a good outcome or moderate disability. In conclusion, 6% of patients developed delayed epidural hematoma after craniectomy, and all of these patients had contralateral calvarial fractures. Patients undergoing decompressive craniectomy for non-penetrating traumatic brain injury had 40% risk of developing delayed epidural hematoma if they had two or more calvarial fractures contralateral to the craniectomy site, as opposed to a 9% risk if they only had one calvarial fracture. Being aware of this association allows for closer monitoring of patients after decompressive craniectomy to hopefully reduce morbidity and mortality. Dr. Joel Stein, assistant professor in neuroradiology, will now discuss the implications, strengths, and limitations of this study.
This is Joel Stein, assistant professor of radiology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you, Dasha, for that nice summary of this interesting article. The real strength of this study, I think, is in highlighting a rare but important and potentially fatal complication of traumatic brain injury and describing straightforward imaging findings that may identify patients at increased risk. Earlier postoperative imaging in such patients could uncover delayed epidural hematoma before it is clinically evident and potentially improve outcomes, though this is not tested. Looking again at their results, the authors found a significant association between multiple skull fractures and the occurrence of delayed epidural hematoma. Using their numbers gives a likelihood ratio of 11, indicating the utility of this measure. The presence of a contralateral calvarial fracture had perfect sensitivity for delayed epidural hematoma. This by itself is not so useful, as the presence of a single calvarial fracture is not very predictive, with a likelihood ratio of only 1.5. There are several limitations of this study, which the authors noted. It is retrospective in nature, they found only 12 patients with delayed epidural hematoma, and it is somewhat limited by lack of more long-term patient follow-up and outcome data. Considering the study's retrospective nature, the authors point out that radiologic imaging protocols as well as patterns and standards of patient care may have varied across the 9-year time period, a source of potential bias and error. I think variation in radiology protocols would be more important if they had found cases of delayed epidural hematoma in which contralateral skull fractures were absent or not evident by CT, though I suppose technological factors could blur the distinction between single bone or multiple bone fractures. As the authors point out, there are cases of delayed epidural hematoma with radiologically occult fractures in the literature, which itself is evolving over time. Interestingly, one of the earliest reports I could find is from Nelson, Kishori, and Lee, writing in the September-October 1982 issue of AJNR, where they described two cases of young men with blunt trauma who developed epidural hematomas after craniectomy. Contralateral temporal bone fractures were not evident at CT, but noted at surgery in one case and autopsy in the other. That article ends with an exhortation to perform skull radiography. Certainly, technology has changed. With current bone algorithm thin section CT, skull fracture should almost always be evident, particularly in retrospect, though I have been taught that scrutinizing the topogram is important, among other reasons, to look for fractures that might be in the plane of the scan and thus not evident on the CT sections. The current article underscores the need to carefully evaluate the trauma head CT scan, as I'm sure we all do, and not fall victim to satisfaction of search in describing the extent of skull fractures and other findings. The authors do not speculate as to why fractures involving more than one calvarial bone are more likely to lead to delayed epidural hematoma after craniectomy. Presumably, this reflects greater severity of trauma or something about the biomechanics of fractures that cross suture lines, increasing the likelihood of dural vessel injury. They do not indicate to what degree the calvarial fractures they found were depressed or displaced. It could be that fractures involving more than one bone among the five considered are simply more likely to involve the parietal and squamosal temporal bones in the region of the middle meningeal artery. Of the patients with delayed epidural hematoma and single bone fractures, one case each involved the parietal, temporal, and occipital bones, and here the small sample size does limit further interpretation. Among patients with single fractures not developing epidural hematoma, 26 were parietal and 19% temporal. Overall, this article presents good evidence for the prognostic value of multiple calvarial fractures contralateral to a site of planned craniectomy, predicting subsequent development of delayed epidural hematoma in the setting of traumatic brain injury. I will certainly consider highlighting this issue in my reports and discussions with neurosurgery colleagues, drawing particular attention to fractures involving the parietal and squamosal temporal bones. That concludes our discussion of this article. On to discuss the next is Dr. Amaya Naithe.
My name is Dr. Amaya Naithe, and I am a junior faculty in neuroradiology at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. I will discuss the purpose, methods, results, and conclusion on the article Diffusion-Weighted MR Imaging in Laryngeal and Hypopharyngeal Carcinoma, Association Between Apparent Diffusion and Coefficient, and Histological Findings by Drissen, J.P. et al., published in Radiology in August 2014. Purpose: MRI is increasingly utilized in imaging of head and neck squamous cell carcinomas because it provides excellent soft tissue contrast in this complex and heterogeneous region. Diffusion-weighted imaging, or DWI, with apparent diffusion coefficient, or ADC, is a MRI sequence that can help differentiate between benign and malignant lesions and predict tumor radiosensitivity by further characterizing the microenvironment of soft tissues. Prior studies demonstrated an inverse relationship between the ADC and cellular density of tumors in prostate cancer and central nervous system lymphomas. However, limited studies have examined this relationship in head and neck tumors. Therefore, the authors investigated the relationship between the histologic characteristics of head and neck squamous cell carcinoma and apparent diffusion coefficient on diffusion-weighted MR imaging. In addition, the authors aim to delineate a potential explanation of the high correlation between high pretreatment ADC and local failure of chemotherapy and or radiation therapy. Methods: 18 patients were enrolled in the study. Inclusion criteria included biopsy-proven laryngeal or hypopharyngeal squamous cell carcinoma without prior treatment, stages T3 or T4 disease, and planned curative total laryngectomy with or without partial pharyngectomy. Patients underwent MRI imaging that included DWI of the neck prior to surgery on a 1.5 Tesla machine. Two patients were excluded from analysis due to imaging or histologic preparation errors. After surgery, the MRT1 post-gadolinium and DWI images of the tumor in the preoperative neck were registered semi-automatically to the pathologic sections of the laryngeal or hypopharyngeal carcinoma. Two physicians in consensus delineated the tumor on the DWI images, and ADC values were calculated. A pathologist determined the cellular density, nuclear area, nucleus to cytoplasm ratio, and stromal area in the corresponding pathology sections of the tumor. Results: ADC was significantly and inversely correlated to the cellular density, the nuclear area, and the nucleus to cytoplasm ratio and positively correlated with the stromal area. All tumors showed less than 5% necrosis, and moderately differentiated tumors showed no difference in ADC compared with poorly differentiated tumors. Conclusion: individual tissue components in laryngeal and hypopharyngeal squamous cell carcinomas significantly affected ADC as demonstrated by the significant correlation of ADC with tumor cellularity, stromal component, and nuclear cytoplasmic ratio. The positive correlation of ADC and stromal component suggests that poor prognostic value of high pretreatment ADC might partly be attributed to the tumor stromal component, a known predictor of local failure. Dr. Suyash Mohan, Assistant Professor of Neuroradiology at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, will now discuss the implications, strengths, and limitations of this study and discuss our institutional experience with diffusion-weighted imaging in head and neck tumors.
Hello, my name is Suyash Mohan, Assistant Professor of Radiology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you, Ameya, for beautifully summarizing this article. When a patient presents with a clinically suspicious laryngeal or hypopharyngeal cancer, the clinician is primarily interested in confirming the suspicion with imaging and or biopsy, but is also interested in knowing the extent of the disease, loco-regional spread, and metastasis. While anatomic imaging can provide answers to most questions, it falls short in the accurate assessment of the biologic status of the cancer, such as cellularity, growth rate, response to therapy, and so forth, which are invaluable for prognostication, planning of therapy, prediction of response to therapy, and follow-up of lesions after therapy. Various biologic techniques, such as MR spectroscopy, MRI diffusion, and perfusion, hold promise such that they can look beyond the size and enhancement of a tumor and explore its molecular nature. The authors of this paper have done a commendable job in exploring the relationship between tissue microanatomy and ADC values and highlighting the importance of diffusion imaging in these patients. They utilized a highly sophisticated and validated registration technique for co-registering consecutive whole mount histologic sections to MR images. In contrast to prior literature, this study extended beyond tissue cellularity by including the investigation of numerous other tissue components such as cellular density, nuclear cytoplasmic and stromal area, and nuclear cytoplasmic ratio within the tumor. Several studies have been conducted to investigate the prognostic value of ADC for determination of pre-therapeutic tumor radiosensitivity, and a high ADC value was reported to be predictive for local non-responders. It is often hypothesized that this is due to necrotic parts within the tumor. The authors have demonstrated that low cell density reflects a large stromal area that contributes to relatively high ADC values and is a known predictor for local failure. This study has several limitations. One limitation of this work was that the diffusion in the neck is inherently affected by geometrical distortions in general. To overcome this, the authors manually delineated the tumor on the DWI sections. Another limitation was that the number of patients was small, especially for the color-based segmentation, where 4 patients had to be excluded because of poor staining intensity. Despite of these limitations, the authors were still able to find significant correlations between ADC and tissue components. The results of this study give us further insights into how ADC reflects the underlying microenvironment of laryngeal and hypopharyngeal cancers. In our experience, we have seen that both baseline ADC as well as change in ADC during therapy have proved useful as predictors of response to therapy. Tumors that responded completely to chemoradiation had decreased baseline ADC values compared with tumors that responded only partially, highlighting that a change in the ADC during therapy can also serve as a better predictor than baseline ADC alone. In addition, there was at least one more recent study which has shown that only the post-treatment ADC was a marker for loco-regional failure. Therefore, it is possible that the true value of ADC in prediction and monitoring of response likely lies in a combination of pre, intra, and post-therapy ADC values, which needs to be worked out in a larger sample to establish its utility. Diffusion imaging has been one of the most investigated biologic imaging modalities in head and neck cancer, primarily due to its ability to acquire reproducible images in a short sequence that can be built into any head and neck MR imaging protocol. Unfortunately, there have been many technical challenges with acquiring diffusion in the neck because of multiple artifacts as well as geometric distortions. These effects together degrade the image quality and limit the spatial resolution and is a primary reason precluding its widespread application in head and neck imaging. Several potential solutions have been put forth, such as parallel imaging, use of shorter echo trains, reducing the field of view, and more recently with commercially available techniques such as Singo Zoom It and Singo Resolve, which we hope will be available at Penn very soon. In summary, biologic imaging of head and neck cancer has come a long way outside the shadows of the research lab and is becoming more and more applicable in the daily evaluation of patients. Ongoing clinical research, as in this manuscript, will help propel us towards customization of treatments and better prognostication, eventually altering the landscape of head and neck cancer care in this era of personalized medicine.
That concludes this episode of the AJNR Fellows Journal Club podcast. I want to thank all of our participants from here at the University of Pennsylvania, and to thank you for listening.